KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Supporting Israel and its efforts to terminate Iran's nuclear capability isn't just a regional security issue. It's a decisive imperative.
How military planners are preparing should President Trump decide to cross the line to direct U.S. involvement in Iran.
For Friday, June 20th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, we'll hear from frightened Iranians trying to flee their capital, Tehran.
Also, Dom Phillips started writing a book on saving the Amazon.
But it was his friends and fellow journalists who finished it.
It's sending out a message that killing a journalist won't silence them. Others will rally around and finish their work.
Plus, indictments in a robbery that prosecutors call the largest jewelry heist in U.S. history.
This story has so much sort of cinematic detail to it, but this is real people's lives at stake who, in some cases, have left the jewelry trade as a result.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Thousands of Americans have reached out to the State Department for information about leaving Israel, the West Bank, and Iran. The U.S. is urging Americans to sign up online to learn about potential evacuation flights and ships, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The State Department says it has given information to more than 25,000 Americans and is encouraging others to reach out by filling out a form on travel.state.gov. The U.S. Embassy in Israel is working on possible evacuation flights and ships, but that's not the case in Iran, where the U.S. doesn't have an embassy. Here's State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce.
We do not anticipate offering direct U.S. government-assisted departure from Iran. Americans seeking departure should take advantage of existing means to leave.
President Trump is expected to decide within the next 2 weeks whether to join Israel in striking Iranian nuclear sites. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
A federal judge ruled that top national security officials who discussed military operations on the messaging app Signal have to take steps to preserve those records. But as NPR's Elena Moore reports, the order doesn't call for the recovery of messages that may have already been deleted.
Signal allows messages to automatically delete after a certain period of time, and that was at the center of this case. In his ruling, Judge James Boasberg said the court has no remedy for bringing back any already lost messages. But he ordered officials to notify the acting archivist of the United States of any messages that could be at risk of being deleted. The lawsuit was first filed months earlier after a journalist was mistakenly added to a Signal group chat where Trump officials discussed a U.S. attack on Yemen. Elena Moore, NPR News.
A federal appeals court blocked a Louisiana law requiring public schools and colleges in the state to display the Ten Commandments, calling it unconstitutional. State officials say they will appeal the ruling. Similar proposals have been introduced in several other states, including Texas, where lawmakers are close to requiring the display. The ongoing heat wave could bring wildfires to the southwest this weekend. Sam Brash of Colorado Public Radio reports forecasters have issued a red flag warning for large parts of the area.
A small fire broke out in western Colorado on Wednesday, briefly closing the main highway connecting Denver to Colorado's mountain towns. Firefighters quickly controlled the blaze, but they're still on high alert. That's due to a combination of heat, dry weather, and high winds. Heading into the weekend, the National Weather Service issued wildfire warnings for parts of Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Nevada, and California.
Sam Brash for reporting. Game 7 of the NBA Finals takes place Sunday night, the first winner-take-all contest in the NBA Finals since 2016. It'll be the Indiana Pacers at Oklahoma Thunder. This is NPR News. Former Columbia University grad student Mahmoud Khalil is out on bail after a federal judge today ordered his release more than 3 months after immigration agents arrested him and detained him. Khalil was being held at an immigration detention center in Louisiana. Today's ruling means he can go back to New York as he continues his fight against the Trump administration's efforts to deport him. He was the first student targeted by President Trump's crackdown on pro-Palestinian protesters. U.S. District Court Judge Michael Farbiars called the government's attempts to continue to detain him, quote, highly, highly unusual. In the government's racketeering case against Sean Diddy Combs, a former assistant today testified he bought drugs for the hip-hop mogul. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has more.
Brendan Paul worked for Combs for about 18 months until he was arrested in March 2024 for possession of drugs. Paul testified that the cocaine authorities found in his bag belonged to Combs, but he did not tell the police out of loyalty to his boss. The former personal assistant also said part of his job included setting up hotel rooms for what were referred to as, quote, wild king nights. These are the drug-fueled sexual performances involving Combs, one of his girlfriends, and male sex workers that lasted multiple days. Paul told the court he cleaned up after these nights on several occasions to avoid damage fees from the hotel. Prosecutors are expected to raise their case against Sean Combs next week. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. It has been a day of diplomacy on Iran, with Iran's foreign minister meeting European counterparts in Geneva. But for now, Iran is still hurtling missiles into Israel. Israel is still hurtling missiles into Iran. And President Trump says he's giving himself a two-week window to decide whether the U.S. will join the fight. Now, that means behind the scenes, Pentagon planners are busy preparing options. For insight into the military planning underway, we have called retired Air Force Lieutenant General Dave Deptula. He's a veteran fighter pilot, served more than 30 years, and was the principal attack planner for the Desert Storm air campaign in Iraq. General, good to speak with you again.
Hey, it's great to be here, Mary Louise. Appreciate it and look forward to our discussion.
In a few sentences, lay out for me what the range of military options might be that the Pentagon would be laying out for President Trump to consider.
Well, we've seen already Israel basically achieve air superiority across the breadth and depth of Iran. And that's fundamentally required as a prerequisite for operational success and strategic impact. So they've done most of the heavy lifting. Where the United States may play a role is in providing some capabilities that Israel does not have on its own.
These are the bunker-busting bombs.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And for a very specific site, it's the Fordo facility that is basically protecting an area of centrifuges that allow the Iranians to further refine uranium to the point where it could be used in a nuclear device.
General, what are the limits of airstrikes? Say you can destroy Fordo and its nuclear facility. That is not the same thing as destroying Iran's nuclear threat.
No, that's true. And that's why it's important to understand that, you know, there are some people running around saying, well, you know, air power alone can't do this. Well, guess what? War fighting at a campaign level doesn't occur in any domain alone. It is the combination of applying the inherent advantages that air power presents, but in coordination with special operations, cyber operations, all the other parts and pieces that go into coercive power. And that's what Israel has put together and has thought about before proceeding with their operations.
So you believe that the U.S. could, should the commander-in-chief decide to go this route, use airstrikes against specific facilities without descending into an extended, broader war?
Yes, absolutely. We shouldn't take a look. There's nothing. Let me retract absolutely, because there's never everything. There's nothing absolute with the conduct of warfare. However, there's a high likelihood that that may be the case. But I'm here to tell you that supporting Israel and its efforts to terminate Iran's nuclear capability isn't just a regional security issue. It's a decisive imperative that would dramatically improve global security, preserve the international order, and deter nuclear proliferation around the world. And that's something that the president needs to consider, because for the last, unfortunately, since Russia invaded Ukraine, the rhetoric of Putin has indicated to other nations watching this that it would be into their benefit to acquire nuclear weapons. So this act of the president to assist the Israelis to denude Iran of its nuclear aspirations has strong geopolitical implications.
How worried would you be, General, about the threat of retaliation against U.S. bases, U.S. forces in the region?
We certainly have to be prepared for just such a response. But then again, the Iranians need to consider what Pandora's box they're opening by doing that.
I mean, I will quote the Iran's defense minister, who has warned, and I'm quoting, all U.S. bases are within our reach and we will boldly target them.
Well, sure they are. I mean, and that's exactly what he's trying to do. He's trying to use rhetoric to prevent us from doing that. And we shouldn't fall into that trap. They've got a hell of a lot more to lose than we do.
Retired Air Force General Dave Deptula. He is Dean of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. General, thank you.
You bet. Have a great day.
And as the Trump administration deliberates on its next move, Israel and Iran continue to pound each other with missiles. Israelis sought shelter in bunkers in several areas. Many Iranians are trying to flee the capital, Tehran, while others have chosen to stay and risk Israeli strikes. NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam has this report.
There has been a near total internet blackout across Iran for the past couple of days. Still, an NPR translator was able to contact three people there to talk about life while under Israeli attack. All of them asked that we not use their full names out of fear of retribution by the Iranian regime for speaking to foreign media. The three displayed a sense of resignation and anger and even some flashes of gallows humor. Mede, a 28-year-old software engineer, describes the chaos of trying to get out of Tehran for the suburb of Karchuk earlier this week.
I heard a loud explosion a quarter of a mile away. My car battery had died. I was standing still right in the middle of chaos of ambulances and people rushing about while I waited for car assistance to come and replace my car battery.
Mede says he didn't hear any sirens before or after the explosion. That's because there aren't any, says Siavash, a 38-year-old painter living in Tehran. He laughs mockingly when the government tries to tell Iranians that Israelis have sirens because they're scared of Iranian missiles.
But we are not scared. That's why we don't have sirens. They said that on Iranian TV channels. They're making fun of Israelis for obeying safety protocols. They hide in the shelters, but our people go to the roof and watch.
Siavash has chosen not to leave Tehran to escape Israeli missiles, despite warnings a few days ago from President Trump to evacuate.
I saw my neighbor today, and he told me the sky has the same color wherever you go. They hit everywhere. How long can you run? We can take 3 or 4 days, but for more than a week, we are not financially prepared for this.
Siavash's friend Yasser, a 35-year-old personal trainer, doesn't want to stay in Tehran, but has little option.
Tehran is quiet and silent, and it's crazy, but I couldn't convince my mom and my family to leave. They decided to stay in one place altogether. At least we can all die together.
Yasser says whatever happens is out of his hands.
If a bomb doesn't hit me now, it may hit tomorrow. So let it finish the job now.
But Mehdi, the software engineer, says Iran is a vast country, and the possibility of a missile hitting an apartment is low.
For example, the 20 missiles that hit every day destroy a maximum of 20 flats in residential apartments. There are 1 to 2 million residential apartments. Statistically, the chance of getting hit by a missile in 1 week is 1 in 400,000.
Even if his math doesn't add up, the odds become shorter the longer this war drags on. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
It's looking like a bad year for tick bites. Data from the CDC show people are seeking emergency care at the highest rates since 2019. So if you are planning a hike or a trip to the park and you want to avoid these blood-sucking bugs, yes, please. And NPR's Ping Huang has some tips to help you fend them off.
People are often surprised by how small ticks are. Here's Rebecca Eisen, a tick researcher at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
If you can picture an everything bagel, an adult is about the size of a sesame seed, so the little white seeds on there, and then the nymphs are about the size of a poppy seed, so those tiny little black seeds.
That's for deer ticks. Lone star ticks and dog ticks can be bigger. All told, there are about a dozen different ticks in the U.S. that can cause problems for human health. In the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and Upper Midwest, the biggest problem is Lyme disease. Thomas Hart is an infectious disease microbiologist at Johns Hopkins University in Maryland. He says Lyme disease is transmitted by infected deer ticks.
You can encounter these ticks really at any time of the year, but they're going to be the most active in warmer months, and they tend to live in woody or grassy areas.
In the central and southeastern U.S., ehrlichiosis and spotted fever rickettsiosis are top concerns, along with a tick-induced allergy to red meat. Tick bites are less common in the West, but they also happen there and can spread Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, and a few other things. So, if all of this is making you itchy, Allison Hinckley, an epidemiologist with CDC, says there are precautions you can take.
You can wear insect-repellent-treated clothing. We call that permethrin-treated clothing. That's a really easy thing to do.
Cover up as much skin as possible and check yourself daily.
Showering when you come in from outside really has shown to be a good way to prevent tick-borne diseases.
That's because the longer a tick feeds on you, the higher the risk of infection. So if you find a tick, take it off right away. The best way is to use tweezers, grab it as close to the skin as you can, and find out what type of tick it is and how long it's been feeding on you. If it's a deer tick and you're in an area where Lyme disease is common, Hinckley says see a doctor.
The only time you would get an antibiotic after a tick bite and before any symptoms, it would be to prevent Lyme disease. And in that case, we recommend just a single dose.
Otherwise, watch for symptoms like fever, aches, and rash. If those show up, Hinckley says seek medical care. You wouldn't be alone. Some 31 million people get tick bites each year. Ping Huang, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The journalist Dom Phillips was deep in a part of the Amazon rainforest known as the Javari Valley, halfway through writing his book about the Amazon, when he and his colleague Bruno Pereira were shot and killed, allegedly by men involved in an illegal fishing operation. Dom's widow, Alessandra Sampaio, told me she knew almost immediately that his unfinished book had to be completed.
After the funeral, it was so intense. And I think that my way to keep going, to keep alive, actually, it was finish this book.
That effort took 3 years. It involved a team of co-writers and editors. And now the book is out, called How to Save the Amazon, A Journalist's Fatal Quest for Answers.
Dom was this person, before being a journalist, he was this person very committed with people. He had the connection with people. He really liked to have a relationship with people.
The presence of indigenous people seems very important to Dom's project, to the finished book, to answering the question, how to save the Amazon. Can you tell me about that relationship he built and the relationship that you continue with indigenous Amazonian people?
Yes. Indigenous around Brazil, not just in Amazon, especially in the Javari Valley, they say to me, because I went in Javari Valley for 3 times, and at the first time I was there, one guy hugged me and said to me, now you are part of our family. Because Dom was part of our family, because he died trying to protect us. So now we will take care of you and you will take care of us. So I have this commitment with them. And they also say that Dom and Bruno became spirits of forest. So now they continue protecting rainforest and its inhabitants.
Halfway through the book, there is a photograph of these two large crosses in the rainforest. And below the image, it says, Dom reached this far in drafting the book by the time of his murder on June 5th, 2022. From this point on, his friends have worked with his plans and notes to complete the missing chapters.
These, for me, it was so hard to see and to read. In that time that I finished to read the Dom's chapter, I realized that Dom was dead. Of course that I know this, but it's another way to feel this again, because I remember a lot our conversations, and when this finished, it's something like, stop these memories, you know what I mean?
Yeah. You had something to pour your emotion and effort into to preserve his memory, and that project
yes.
is now done.
Yes, there is his legacy, and this case touched so many people.
One of the journalists who helped finish the book is Jonathan Watts. He remembers after his friend was killed asking, what can we do?
And so the spirit of this was very much, this will be done. It was an act of defiance. So the instruction I gave to every contributor was, go to the places Dom went, talk to the people Dom talked to, look for the solutions that Dom was looking for, but in the end, have a dialogue with Dom. Try to get Dom involved, use your memories of Dom. And I think because there was a sort of a shared style and a shared approach, that instead of being very different voices for each chapter, it sort of comes together in a kind of a polyphonic whole where all the different voices actually come together in unison.
It's clear from reading the book that the task would have been easier if his handwriting were a bit more legible.
Yes. Just about every contributor pointed out how much of a challenge it was to decipher his scrawl.
Tell us about how this translated specifically to your chapter. You write the last chapter in the book where you try to actually answer the question that the book's title, How to Save the Amazon, poses. You ask, what was his conclusion?
Yes. So I was left, like many of the chapter contributors, with a riddle. I knew that Dom had written some references to how he wanted the book to end. So he'd said, for example, listen to indigenous people. That was one very prominent phrase. And another phrase was close on the scene in Medicilandia with the students and the professor. And wow, I knew the first, you know, listen to indigenous people. Okay, that was very clear, and that's something I could follow. The second part was a real mind bender, because
who are the students? Who's the professor?
Who's the students exactly? What's going on? Where do I begin? I knew that Medicilandia was a town, and fortunately, the neighboring town to where I live, I also live in the Amazon rainforest. But I spent more than a year trying to solve this conundrum. And eventually, an old friend of Dom's called Daniel Carmagos, a Brazilian journalist, he suggested, look, why don't you talk to the driver Dom was using at the time? And he passed on the contact. And sure enough, that unlocked everything. And the driver, a guy called Elio, he said, yeah, sure, I can take you to all those places. And that professor and those students, I know them. And my heart leapt at that point. It was just like, yes, 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 here we go. And sure enough, we went to the same places, talked to the people. And at the very end, I looked at the visitor's book of the last person I spoke to, and one of the last people that Dom would have spoken to on this particular trip. And there it was, that scrawl. And so I ended the book, hopefully, at least close to the spirit in which Dom intended.
The book itself has a message, but the act of completing the book sends a different message. What message do you think that sends?
It's two things. It's defiance and it's solidarity. It's defiance because it's sending out a message that killing a journalist won't silence them, that others will rally around and finish their work and, if possible, even amplify their work. And then the solidarity was just a coming together of this huge number of friends and family. And it was a way for us to kind of help each other and divide the work that we have to do, but also divide some of the suffering that we felt with the really extraordinarily horrible and brutal death of our friend and the guide he was with, who he admired enormously and who was very important to helping to save the Amazon, Bruno Pereira.
Jonathan Watts is one of the co-authors of the Dom Phillips book, How to Save the Amazon, A Journalist's Fatal Quest for Answers. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you, Ari. I really appreciate your interest.
This is NPR News.
Tourists may only spend a few days at any one destination, but the impact on the local ecosystems can last much longer, particularly as people seek adventures in more far-off places.
If we want that Antarctica that we have now to remain as it is, then we have to exert more control. Tourism.
I'm Andrew Limbong, and we're asking how to be a responsible traveler on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, a new album from the sister bandmates in the group Haim.
It explores the freedom and wisdom that come after a breakup.
The thing that was so great about us all being single is we very much bonded so much more on this album than I think we had on any other album.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Former Columbia University graduate student Mahmoud Khalil has been released on bail from a Louisiana immigration jail by order of a federal district court judge in New Jersey. He was arrested and detained by immigration agents 3 months ago as the first student targeted by President Trump's crackdown on pro-Palestinian protesters. The war between Israel and Iran is now in its eighth night, with troops and civilians on both sides dealing with extensive damage and casualties. Reporters this afternoon asked President Trump if he would ask Israel to suspend its attacks.
I think it's very hard to make that request right now. If somebody's winning, it's a little bit harder to do than if somebody's losing. But we're ready, willing, and able, and we've been speaking to Iran, and we'll see what happens.
The UN Security Council today met in emergency sessions for a second time since Israel and Iran have been trading rocket fire. The BBC is accusing artificial intelligence firm Perplexity of using the broadcaster's content without permission or payment. NPR's Bobby Allen reports it's the latest fight between news publishers and the AI industry.
Lawyers for the BBC are threatening legal action against AI search engine Perplexity unless it stops hoovering up the broadcaster's content. In a letter first reported by the Financial Times, the BBC says Perplexity reproduces news stories verbatim, circumventing the need to ever visit the BBC's website. Perplexity, backed by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, competes with ChatGPT. In a statement, Perplexity said the BBC's claims are manipulative and opportunistic and only serve to uphold, quote, Google's illegal monopoly. The dispute is the latest in a long string of battles over how leading AI tools scan, reproduce, and use copyrighted material. News outlets say the content is not being paid for and that there is a risk that the material is being mischaracterized by AI. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. Today marks the summer solstice, the Northern Hemisphere's longest day of the year. NPR's Amy Held reports for much of the eastern half of the U.S., the first day of summer is also bringing extreme heat.
On the summer solstice, the Earth's tilt is at its most extreme, toward the sun, making it the brightest day of the year. With roughly 15 hours of daytime in the U.S., depending on location, and marking the start of summer, that for tens of millions of people is coming in hot, thanks to a heat dome. Starting this weekend, going into next week, record-breaking heat indices are forecast around 100 degrees. The risk of extreme heat extending from Chicago to Washington, D.C. As the planet warms, heat records are falling more often. Meantime, in England, Saturday morning, revelers will see the sunrise into the heart of Stonehenge, marking the solstice, as people have done for millennia. Amy Held, NPR News.
A hiking trail in Canada's Banff National Park was the scene of a fatal rock fall this week. Today, teams located a second body from the slide, which occurred yesterday afternoon north of Lake Louise, about 100 miles north of Calgary. Three other people have been hospitalized. The trail's considered a moderate challenge and is commonly used by tourists. One experienced hiker said he was surprised to see the rock fall spinning boulders the size of tires. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Subaru and its retailers, partnering with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society this June to give blankets and messages of hope to patients facing cancer. Learn more at subaru.com/care. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. A federal judge has ordered the Trump administration to release Mahmoud Khalil from federal custody. Khalil is the former Columbia University grad student who ICE agents arrested back in March over his pro-Palestinian activism. They flew him from New York to Louisiana. He has been at a rural detention center there for more than 3 months while fighting the government's attempt to deport him. NPR's Adrian Florido is here to tell us more. And Adrian, what did the judge say today in ordering Khalil's release?
Well, Judge Michael Farbiage of the federal court in New Jersey said that Khalil's lawyers had convinced him that the government was likely detaining Khalil in retaliation for his pro-Palestinian activism. And he said that that would be unconstitutional. And so he ordered the government to release Khalil on bail while his lawsuit challenging his deportation continues in federal court. This was not a final decision on Khalil's case. Mm-hmm. It just means, Mary Louise, that he will be able to return home to New York while he continues fighting his deportation.
Still, this is a big victory for Khalil. Have we heard from him or his lawyers?
We've heard from his lawyers. They're ecstatic. Khalil, you may remember, was the first of a handful of pro-Palestinian student activists who the Trump administration arrested for deportation when it began its crackdown several months ago. But he's the only one of those students who had not yet been released from detention. I spoke a little while ago with one of his attorneys, Bahar Asmi.
We're all profoundly relieved that Mahmoud is finally out of his cruel remote detention, but equally outraged that it took this long and that Mahmoud had to fight this hard to challenge just obviously outrageous and patently unconstitutional government conduct.
Mary Louise, Khalil and his lawyers have always maintained that the government is retaliating against him for his pro-Palestinian activism and his protests against Israel's war in Gaza.
Well, and just go back a little bit and remind us how he came to be on the government's radar, why they have been trying to deport him.
Well, Khalil was one of the leaders of the pro-Palestinian protests that consumed Columbia University's campus last year. And President Trump, when he returned to office in January, promised to deport non-citizen activists who he accused of promoting Hamas terrorism against Israel. So Secretary of State Marco Rubio revoked his green card and said that he was engaging in anti-Semitic protests and that he threatened U.S. foreign policy because of that. So after ICE arrested him, they flew him to Louisiana. And it's important to note, Mary Louise, that the government has never provided evidence to support its accusations against Khalil. And the judge noted that in ordering him released today. Khalil has also never been charged with a crime. But the government has been trying very hard to deport him. And it convinced an immigration judge in Louisiana at that detention center where he's being held to order him deported. But this federal judge up in New Jersey has said, not so fast. There are some serious constitutional issues here.
Have we had reaction yet from the Trump administration to this order that he be released?
Tricia McLaughlin, a DHS spokeswoman, said in a statement today that, quote, this is yet another example of how out-of-control members of the judicial branch are undermining national security. And she suggested that the Trump administration is not done fighting this case.
And NPR's Adrian Florido, thank you.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
Federal prosecutors may have finally pinpointed the culprits behind what they call the largest jewelry heist in U.S. history. They have indicted seven defendants, charging them with allegedly robbing a Brinks security truck back in July 2022 and making away with up to $100 million worth of gold, precious gems, and luxury watches. To tell us all about it, we're joined now in the studio by Daniel Miller, who's been reporting on this story since the very beginning of it for the L.A. Times. Welcome to NPR West.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so just remind us how this all played out, because this wasn't just some smash and grab jewelry robbery, right?
That's right. This was a sophisticated case, and it began in July 2022 at a jewelry show in Northern California. At the conclusion of this jewelry show in San Mateo, all of these jewels, diamonds, you name it, they were loaded up on a Brinks big rig, and that big rig started a journey to Southern California. Along the way, we now know, this big rig was followed by thieves who allegedly broke into it while it was parked at a truck stop in the Grapevine, about 70 miles north of Los Angeles.
Right. One driver was getting a meal. The other driver was asleep inside the truck, right?
That's right. And that is the detail that first got my attention. So this big rig is parked at this truck stop around 2 a.m. And what we know is that there was a 27-minute window where the thieves had the time to make off with 24 bags of jewelry.
I bet that sleeping driver felt so bad.
You know, we haven't been able to interview the sleeping driver. We certainly have tried. I think people want to know, how did he not wake up, right? I know that's one of our questions.
It's one of mine. Okay, so what do we know at least about the seven alleged co-conspirators who were named in this indictment?
So there were seven co-conspirators. Their ages roughly 30 to 60. And they have allegedly some experience in heists, although they are smaller ones. We learned from the indictment that these men were also involved in a series of burglaries and robberies, allegedly in Southern California in the months ahead of the Brinks heist. These were much smaller. I think the biggest take was allegedly about $250,000. Nonetheless, there were similar tactics where they were following vehicles and then breaking into them when they were empty.
Right, but not humongous jewelry trucks in those heists.
That's right, yeah. I mean, $100 million is a big number, of course.
Yeah.
We should also say that it's in dispute. Brinks says that this jewelry is worth far less.
That's right. There's some litigation right now between Brinks and these affected jewelers about the actual value of what was lost. Do we know what the latest is in that litigation?
So almost since the heist occurred, these parties have been fighting it out in court, both in New York and Los Angeles. And the case that is the farthest along is the one in New York. And basically, Brinks has said, look, these customers of ours, they signed manifests that in total said the value of the jewelry we were transporting was about $8.7 million. And they've effectively asked the court to enforce those contracts, and then Brinks would pay out something like $8.7 million. The jewelers in their own suit say, right. No.
Way more than that.
This was worth, you know, more than 10 times that amount. And that is what they allege in their lawsuit in Los Angeles, but that one is just not as far along.
Well, I know that you talked to one of the jewelers who was robbed. How are they processing all of this news right now?
That's right. I spoke to John Malkey within hours of the indictment being unsealed. He was speechless. He did not know what to say. He was thankful that the authorities had taken this action after so many years. And I think most of all, he was desperate to know whether any of his jewelry has been recovered, because we should say that the authorities have announced that they have recovered some items. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this has destroyed their livelihoods in many cases.
Yeah, and with a loss like that.
That's right. And, you know, I think this story has so much sort of cinematic detail to it, right? But I do try to remind myself, this is real people's lives at stake who, in some cases, have left the jewelry trade as a result.
That is LA Times reporter Daniel Miller. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Last week's assassination of a top Minnesota state lawmaker and her husband has resurfaced the issue of how best to protect elected officials. Enhancing security can be expensive, restrictive, and it's not foolproof. And officials in Minnesota are trying to strike a balance between their public-facing jobs and their personal safety and privacy. Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters reports from the state capitol in St. Paul.
In front of the Minnesota House chamber, people stop by a memorial for Democratic House Leader Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark. They drop off flowers, hug, and write messages on sticky notes.
I think we would be not honest if we didn't recognize the fear that's embedded in this.
That's Minnesota Democratic Senate Majority Leader Erin Murphy. She says lawmakers need to address safety in the wake of Hortman's murder. Anyone can walk into the state house. There are no metal detectors.
It will alter the way we interact And we have to be careful not to go so far that we fence off the voice of people in our democracy.
While security in the Capitol is one thing, Melissa and Mark Hortman were killed in their home. The suspect also shot and wounded State Senator John Hoffman and his wife in their home. Law enforcement found a list of lawmakers and their addresses in the alleged killer's vehicle. Minnesota's Secretary of State quickly removed lawmaker addresses from state databases. But Democratic State Senator Eric Putnam says he doesn't plan to remove his details.
We need to be allowed to have a personal life and an own home and have our own spaces. And I think that as legislators, it should be our choice how much of that we give up.
Former Secret Service agent Bill Gage tells NPR it's nearly impossible to fully protect every member of Congress, let alone thousands of state lawmakers in the country. In Minnesota, there are 201 legislators, and a state law allows them to tap their campaign accounts for personal or home security to a degree. Hundreds gathered on the steps of the Capitol this week for a candlelight vigil for the Hortmans. Lynn Billing came to pay her respects and says she doesn't want the murders to cause a chilling effect.
I'm hoping for the opposite. I'm hoping that people are even more determined than ever to get involved, especially younger people. We need you.
Aaron Priest, a teacher, ran unsuccessfully for a House seat a couple of times and knew the Hortmans. She's not sure if she'll run for office again.
I ran because of the things that Melissa was fighting for. Gun violence prevention, education for all, paid family leave. Those things are really important to me, and she really moved the needle on that. There's still work to be done, so maybe, but it's also a huge consideration about safety and my family's safety moving forward, too.
There were no political signs at the vigil, no speakers either. It was a time for a House equally split between parties to come together to honor a colleague. Minnesota's Republican Speaker of the House, Lisa Damoth, worked closely with Melissa Hortman.
We could disagree on things, but we didn't have to be cruel to each other in the process, and that's in the public or in private. And I think that is an example that can lead as we go forward over the next days and months.
Still, these shocking killings have trampled the sense of safety here, and addressing lawmaker security is paramount. Even this week, someone broke into the Hortman's home, the crime scene, and police are investigating. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in St. Paul.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Breakups are the absolute worst. Am I right? I mean, yeah, they take on all kinds of shapes. But, you know, there are few things in life that can throw at you that same lovely mix of hurt, anger, grief, fatigue, loneliness, and utter disorientation, yeah? And yet, you're always reminded after breakups by your friends, maybe by your therapist, that you can grow from this horrendous experience. You can learn and evolve and maybe even get back out there filled with more strength and self-knowledge than you've ever had before. Whatever. Well, breakups, my friends, is what the rock trio Haim contemplates on their new album called I Quit. You gotta tell me the truth if you don't wanna try. It's an album that's rooted in the pain of breaking up, but that also celebrates the freedom and wisdom that can come from it. It is the band's first album in 5 years, and the three sister bandmates, Danielle, Esty, and Alana, join me now to talk all about it. Hey, Haim.
Hi.
Hello.
Oh my God, you guys talk in unison. That's amazing.
We do.
Guilty.
I know, in harmony almost.
I know, that was like a beautiful chorus. Okay. Let's just start like with a lightning round. Worst breakup ever. I'll start first.
Okay.
One of my worst breakups, there's so many to choose from, is when a guy told me that kissing me was like kissing a really good friend.
Oh, terrible.
I don't want that.
Okay. I know.
Isn't that the what every that's
unforgivable.
Everything I've ever wanted is like a best friend to
I know.
Like,
I know. I'd be like, oh my God, thank
that's
you.
That's so nice. I know.
I would okay. take you it as a compliment. This is Alana. I think my worst breakup was my first breakup ever. He never said I love you. And when he broke up with me in his car, we were on the freeway and he broke up with me right before our exit and I had to stay in the car for like an extra 15 minutes.
Oh, brutal.
That's truly brutal.
This is Danielle and my worst breakup, I lived with an ex and he broke up with me and then immediately went on tour. He was a musician too. And he tasked his mom with packing up all of my things and she did so in trash bags and put the photos of us together in said trash bags.
Oh my God, that's hurtful. All right, last one up.
So this is Esty. I'm a type 1 diabetic and I had a boyfriend and I told him, like, you know, just so you know, like, there's a possibility that if we had kids, there's a 5% chance they might have diabetes, like, just so you know. And he said, then why would we have kids?
Oh, my God.
Terrible.
Dun, dun, dun.
To jail. To jail he goes. To jail he goes.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, wait, I think this is done.
Terrible.
Thank you so much, you guys, for sharing all that. Okay, so I guess like my overarching question. So why do an album about breakups in this particular time of your lives? Like, what's going on with all of you?
You know what's so interesting is like we kind of, you know, I don't think we set out to make a so-called breakup album, but obviously there's songs about breakups in here, but I think more so for us, this album was about, you know, self-discovery. Now I'm gone, quick as a gunshot, born to run, can't be held up. Now I'm free, finally. We did all find ourselves single in this moment while we were writing this album.
Right, for the first time.
For the first time since high school.
We're all single at the same time.
Yes. And if people don't know that we are sisters. So we, you know, the last time we were all single was when we were all living under the same roof with our mom and dad, kind of in our teen years. So I think the thing about this album is we don't really view it as a breakup album. We view it as kind of like a self-discovery and getting back in touch with ourselves album and finding, you know, strength in that. You can hate me.
You can shame me for what I've done. You can't make me disappear. You never saw me for what I was. You can't fake it.
No, you can't.
And I won't make you.
No, I won't.
I won't change you. Since I'm gone.
Well, you know, so much of this album, it's not just about romantic relationships, as we're saying, but it's about relationships, about leaving something that once meant something to you. And it made me think about the relationship among the three of you, as sisters, as bandmates. Can you just talk about, like, that relationship? How does that play out creatively in the studio? Like, I assume you all disagree once in a while.
Yeah,
so
how does that unfold?
And how does it resolve?
You know? I mean, I think with us, I think the thing that's so great about, I mean, going back to all three of us being single and making this album is all of a sudden we found ourselves, it just being us three and not having a plus one. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much, like, you don't, like, I feel like anyone that has a sibling will
or
agree.
Or even a friend who, like, is always with their
boyfriend, you know,
or
that, like,
girlfriend.
Once they get it in a relationship, just vibes change. Things change, and it's natural, and it's not, doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing or a good thing. I think the thing that was so great about us all being single is we very much bonded so much more on this album than I think we had on any other album. And we were going to bars together. We were going to parties together.
And the dynamic changes, I think, when you have, like, a significant other with you.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the same as
you
when it's just
the three
of us. You
tend to leave the party a little earlier.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
We've, totally. And I've dated some wet mops. You know what I mean? Some stinkers. Dated some stinkers.
Oh, we all have.
You know? But, like, also, like, you know, there's, to Alana's point, I think it was just really nice for it to just be the three of us kind of running around together and not having to answer to anyone, you know?
That was Esty, Danielle, and Alana Heim. Their new album, I Quit, is out now. Thank you so much for this group therapy session, you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
You for having us.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.